All right.
Okay, so Maxime's going to provoke us further about experimentation in the next 20 years.
All right, so when I saw Michael about a month ago, he told me specifically that my goal is not to summarize the workshop. I learned about 20 seconds ago that that's what I'll do, so actually that's not what I'll do. So instead it will be a set of personal opinions. So I think where we are here is we're in a stage where technological developments and new ideas make a huge array of new experiments in particle physics feasible. However, resources and manpower are not unlimited. Sorry, very good. Are not unlimited, right? That's my vision, yeah. So somebody somewhere somehow will need to make some choices. The primary goal of our field is to determine the laws governing nature at the most fundamental level possible. I think this is the last statement in this talk that we will all agree on. I think that experimental programs should be judged, at least by us theorists, according to how much they advance this goal. And in some sense, it's up to us to provide this input. And the metrics we'll provide will vary greatly among people in this room and people in the community in general. But I think what we should do is we should try to each provide some sense of what our own metric is. And my assumption is that it will then be convoluted with technological and political considerations by others. So this will sort of not take any of that essentially into account, just try to focus on the physics. So I'll try to focus on three physics questions which I care deeply about and that can be tackled experimentally, at least partially within the time span relevant for this talk. And I will organize them according to the three frontiers, and I know that the purpose of this workshop was to mix up the frontiers, so I'm sorry about doing it that way. Okay, so energy frontier. I think the big question for the next 20 years on the energy frontier is the electroweak scale natural? So as you know, we're just coming off a big triumph in this frontier. The Higgs boson has been discovered. And when you have a success, it's natural to try to draw some lessons for the future, right? And try to think about what it was that we did right. And of course, many things went right. But I want to draw one lesson that will be just relevant for my talk. So the amazing thing about this Higgs discovery is, of course, it's a wonderful thing, not to detract from it. But it's not surprising at all. Like in the theory community, it generated essentially no surprise at all. Everybody was ready for it. And the reason is this plot, right? Since the 1990s, the existence of the Higgs, of the light Higgs, was very strongly hinted at. And the where to look area was pretty well constrained by precision electroweak studies, right? So this is a plot from 2006. There are older ones that look similar. So we essentially knew very well where to look. And the observed mass is perfectly consistent with this plot. Okay, a better version of this plot that Michael Peskin made is this one. So these are S&T parameters. And a heavier Higgs boson would contribute to this oblique parameters in a way that's illustrated by this trajectory. While precision electroweak measurements put a limit on these S&T parameters, and they limited us, again, circa 2006, to this ellipse. And you can see that a heavy Higgs, like a 500 GeV or 1,000 GeV Higgs, at which case, and at which point this is really a strongly coupled electroweak symmetry breaking theory, is just way outside of this ellipse. Right? Now, does this prove there is a light Higgs? No, it doesn't. It's not a mathematical theorem. Right? These large contributions from an absence of a Higgs or a heavy Higgs could have been canceled by some other new physics contribution, right? Carefully tuned at 1 part in 10 or 1 part in 100 level. To bring it maybe to introduce some positive T parameter and bring it back up here, right? It's possible, models like that people have written down, that's not what happened. So the lesson that we learned actually hundreds of times before, it's not a new lesson at all, is that nature is not a sneaky, mean-spirited, malicious beast. Nature is not out to get us. Nature is nice. It loves us, okay? Nature is natural, okay? So Higgs properties are beginning to emerge at the LHC. So it looks very much like zero plus. Some alternatives are just theoretically inconsistent, like Lander-Young theorem. Others are constrained by measurements. So this is the famous two plus, which is now more than 2 sigma away from data. So it really looks like a scalar. And the rates look standard model-like at, I would say, roughly 30% level. Better in some channels, worse in others. But overall, this is what it is. And so I think most of us at the back of our minds now have this working hypothesis that this Higgs is standard model to zeroth order. If there are deviations from the standard model, which is, of course, perfectly possible, there should be some sort of small systematic parameter that would control that. Okay. So with this hypothesis, let's think about the standard model Higgs. The standard model Higgs, as you all know, has this potential. Before we knew one combination of them, now we know the other one, so we can solve for the quartic coupling and the mass parameter. And the mass parameter happens to be about 90 GeV, and the quartic about 0.13. Okay. So the question I want to ask is how reasonable, how natural are these values? And I'll focus heavily on the mass parameter because the arguments about the mass parameter can be made in a much more broad model-independent fashion. The quartic is important in some models, like BMSSM famously has quite a bit of trouble getting up to this 0.13. But that's a much more model-dependent question, and so I think in the broad picture that I'm trying to present here, it's the mass parameter that matters. Okay. So why wouldn't it be natural? Well, we've known since the 70s, of course I learned much later, but people knew since the 70s, that the Higgs mass parameter receives radiative corrections that are quadratically divergent, right? So if you look at the mass parameter that we've just measured, right, the 90 GeV is here. This consists of some high scale value that I call mu tree, and this high scale can be, you know, at a TeV or 10 TeV, it can be some effective theory, or it can be very high. And then there is the loop contribution, and the loop contribution, when you compute it, is quadratically divergent. So this lambda x is the scale of new physics that comes in and cuts off this divergence at some point, right? Now, the x here is just a label that labels various standard model fields, and this will be important on the next slide, but it's not important now. Now, you have these two contributions. According to Wilson, they come from different energy scales, so they have to have different physical origin, so they shouldn't really be correlated with each other. And so it's unnatural to have these two things be large, have opposite signs, and result in something that's smaller than either one of them. It's natural for this loop contribution to be, in particular, of the same order or less than the number that we just measured. Okay. What this tells you is where the cutoff should be. The cutoff should be at 1 TeV divided by this coefficient Cx. A simple measure of violation of naturalness is delta, where you just take the value of this loop that I call delta mu squared, and you divide it by the final correct answer that we just measured. Okay, it's a very simple measure. There are many other ways to measure naturalness. We spent some time this morning arguing about them. They're all equivalent to order one factors, so I'll just use the simplest possible. All right. So now the C's, why did I have the C's? Well, I had the C's there because there is a hierarchy in the standard model couplings to the Higgs. The top is by far the strongest coupling ones, coupled ones, right? The SU2 and T1 gauge bosons have slightly smaller couplings, but still significant. Everybody else is so weakly coupled to the Higgs as to be essentially irrelevant. The gluon is not coupled to the Higgs at all in the Lagrangian, but of course the gluon is strongly coupled to the top. And so at two loop order, this gluons will, the divergence of, due to the gluons will feed into the Higgs mass in a big way. But what this suggests is that really we should worry most about the top, and that's what I'll spend most of this part of the talk talking about. Okay? So for the top, this number C happens to be 6, and so the scale lambda happens to be 400 GeV. That's not that high. This energy scale is already being probed at the LHC, and most importantly, it will be definitively probed in the next decade. Now, what are the options for new physics? Well, the most brute force option is to just put a cutoff at lambda q, have some strong dynamics there, right? So the Higgs is no longer an elementary particle. It's some composite thing, like a QCD meson. Precision electric constraints effectively kill this possibility. So such Higgs models would be fine-tuned at least 1% level. A much more attractive alternative is that naturalness is restored by weakly coupled physics at the sub-TeV scale. This would require relations between new particles and standard model couplings to the Higgs, okay? And that's pretty non-trivial. You can't just throw in some random, you know, new physics. There is some real structure that's required. So the model builders have put a lot of effort into trying to construct such models. There are several solutions. The most attractive by far is supersymmetry. The next one on my list is the idea which imagines that there is some strong coupling at the 10 TeV scale, and then the remainder of the hierarchy is stabilized by the Higgs being some sort of pseudo-number Goldstone boson. So there's some explicitly broken, slightly explicitly broken global symmetry. This is realized in, for example, little Higgs models. And so the real point that I want to emphasize here is that pretty definitive experimental tests of naturalness are feasible on the relevant timescales, essentially independent of the model. So of course, how precisely you do this test of naturalness does depend on the model in a big way. So I'll show you a couple of examples that many of you have seen. So this is the search for top partners. This is a spin zero top partner, also known as stop. So this is what happens in supersymmetry. The bound that the LHC is currently producing as the sort of headline bound is about 700 GeV. According to my measure, it's about 10% fine-tuned. Okay? Is that bad? I think it's actually fairly bad. Luckily, there are several large holes in this argument. So for example, this produced stops would decay to neutralinos and tops. The energy of the objects that, that are produced by tops and are visible depend on the neutralino mass as well as the stop mass. In particular, if the neutralino is heavier than about 250 GeV, those tops are too soft, the top decay products are too soft to produce large missing energy that's required to suppress backgrounds in the searches. And so at this point, there is no bound at all in that kinematic regime. OK, is this malicious? No, I don't think so. 250, 700, there's no huge degeneracy between anything. There are no huge coincidences. This is sort of order one. It's a little bit unlucky, but it's order one at this point. Okay. There are other examples, like stealthy spectrum, for example. There's no bound at all if R parity is violated, which until recently I thought was crazy, but my colleagues Chaba and Yuval have recently convinced me otherwise with this little model that they wrote down. Okay. So what if the top partner is spin half? This is what happens in this little Higgs models that, or pseudo-number Goldstone boson models that I mentioned. Well, there you can search for them too. And the search is completely different, but the bound you get is pretty similar. It's about 650 GeV. This implies 10% fine-tuning. There are probably holes here as well. Fewer people work on this model, so the whole papers haven't been written, but I'm sure they can be. OK. I told you that gluons play a role too. They couple to the top. Therefore, they contribute to the Higgs mass. This was so motivated by this, there are now searches for stops coming out of gluino decays. There are pretty strong bounds on R parity conserving gluinos, about 1.3 GeV, TeV. This actually helps reduce some of the holes. So for example, if the stop is stealthy, approximately degenerate with the top, you know, the gluino would still be able to decay to it, and the gluino needs to be way higher in mass than that stop, which in turn implies some amount of fine tuning. So the searches are sort of combined with direct stop searches. Really help to push the push into some of those holes that I mentioned. And also, interestingly enough, even if R parity is violated and there is no missing energy at all, gluino-initiated events can produce some pretty exotic-looking signatures, such as same-sign dileptons. And that means that even in RPV scenarios, you have significant bounds on the gluino mass, and therefore through this natural relation from the stop mass. Okay. What's the future of direct searches? Well, there are two obvious directions, up in mass and close the holes. There's some projections from Atlas which look extremely conservative to me. So I think new ones are on the way. Closing the holes is especially interesting. This will probably require some new ideas from theorists, maybe new observables. I'm actually co-convening a new physics in top working sub group. So if you're interested in this subject, please let me know. So one interesting idea is that compressed spectrum may be explored with ISR tagging that we talked a little bit about this morning. I think an important question for snow mass are there holes that can be only closed at the Lebedev collider? So at the end of the LHC program, will there still be holes? And how big will they be? I mean, if it's a tiny little hole, then maybe we don't care so much, but you know, maybe they're big enough to matter. So I don't know what the answer is. Okay, so I want to very briefly say something that's specific to SUSY. So in SUSY, there are actually two contributions to what I call the tree-level Higgs mass. One comes from the SUSY breaking soft mass, and the other comes from the SUSY preserving F term. And the logic of naturalness is two things that have nothing to do with each other should not cancel. So that means that this mu has to be around our 90 GeV measured Higgs mass parameter scale as well. And so we expect Higgsinus to be light. This plot shows a bound on the Higgsinus of about 300 GeV, so that implies about 10% fine tuning. There are still some caveats, so this imagines that the Higgsinus that's produced decays into a beta, which is significantly lighter. So, you know, if there is only the Higgsinus, for example, there is a present no bound. I think this is a very tough scenario for the LHC to probe. I think part of the snow mass process should be understanding whether this particular hole, which is very important for low energy supersymmetry, can be closed in the future in the LHC. Okay, so now I want to switch gears a little bit. So I talked about direct searches for dog partners. I want to talk a little bit about a slightly more indirect way to address this, which has to do with the Higgs. Right, so naturalness and Higgs go together, right? Naturalness is all about the Higgs mass parameter, and if you think about the quantum corrections to the Higgs potential and therefore the Higgs mass, right? The neatest way to compute it is was described by Coleman and Feinberg many years ago, right? It's just this formula, and this is contributions of anything to the Higgs potential, the crucial input into this, right, is this Higgs-dependent mass of all the particles in your theory, right? So if you know that, then basically you know the Higgs potential. So let's again focus on the top sector. And imagine that there is some top partner, it can have any spin you want, any quantum numbers you want, whatever, that has this mass. So we know what its contribution to the Higgs potential is from this formula. And there can even be many of them. Cancellation of the top quadratic divergence fixes basically the coefficients of h squared in this mass. Right, so there is a sum rule that tells you that some combination of the C's has to add up to 6 top U power squared. Okay? And then the next term in the expansion of this potential is log divergence. And that's where our potential fine-tuning will come from so that's basically the way to quantify it. So the cool thing is that the low energy theorems for the Higgs that have also been known for many years since the late 70s give the top partner contributions to Higgs glu glu and Higgs gamma couplings in terms of exactly the same object, the Higgs dependent top partner mass. Okay, so you can basically write down the Wilson coefficients of these two operators. So one is how I parameterize the contribution of the standard model top, right? So this coefficient is just taken out. And then these new terms are the contributions of the top partners. And again, once I know there are, you know, Higgs-dependent masses, quantum numbers just come in as coefficients, I know exactly what that contribution is. So what this tells you is very general, very robust result. There is an inverse correlation between fine-tuning and non-standard model contributions to glu-glu and gamma-gamma couplings of the Higgs. Okay? And this is, again, very model-independent. The only exception is if, for some reason, the top partners are non-colored and non-charged. But on Wednesday, Matthew explained how Higgs precision measurements can, in fact, deal with that. Okay, there can also be accidental cancellations between various terms in the sum, but nature is not mean. I believe that. Okay, so I'm going to show you a couple of plots very quickly that come from a benchmark example where I have a single top partner with spin 0 or half with quantum numbers of the standard model top. If you like supersymmetry, this can be the MSSM with degenerate stops. It's really pretty model independent. So this shows the deviation of the gluon coupling, the Higgs glu-glu coupling from the standard model, fractional deviation, as a function of the mass of the spin zero top partner. Okay, and so a 1% measurement of this coupling will probe the top partner mass of about 1.2 TeV, which is actually similar to what the LHC will be probing in the next round. Okay. You've seen this figure a bunch of times. So 1% is something that the next generation Higgs precision program aspires to. And we can convert it into fine tuning. So if, for example, nothing is seen, which I personally don't think is what will happen, but if nothing is seen, this will imply fine tuning of at least one part in 25 in a completely model independent. Now, I showed you this plot before, so I decided to plot this test so that it looks as much like that one as possible, right? So this is the plane of the gluon and photon couplings of the Higgs, right? And when you measure them, right, when you go out and measure the gamma-gamma and glu-glu rates, it places you inside some ellipse. Of course, if you agree with the standard model, one point should be inside this ellipse, and it is. So this is actually the fit to the present data. And the top partners put you somewhere on this trajectory. Okay? The spin zero top partners put you on the blue trajectory. The spin half top partners put you on the red trajectory. And the more you shrink this ellipse, which is what the future Higgs coupling measurements will do, the better you're able to constrain the mass of the top partners, or, which I think is much more likely, you will see that one ultimately doesn't fit, and you will be able to see where in this trajectory you are. Okay? So there is a program of precision Higgs measurements that's out there, that's possible with the experimental facilities that we're discussing here, that gives a robust test of naturalness, similar to the tests of electric symmetry breaking by electric precision program that we very successfully had in the past. And it's complementary to direct stop searches in many ways. So there are no holes that, you know, so none of that applies. It has its own holes. There may be, you know, accidental cancellations among the partner loops. But, you know, if neither of them sees anything, then you can really be sure. All right, so what's at stake with naturalness? So as I tried to explain, robust experimental probes of naturalness of electric symmetry breaking at the 1% level are within our reach with the program that we're discussing here. Okay, my bet is we will discover new physics, but what if not? Well, if we don't, I think it will be a tremendously important result. Okay, so if no new physics at TEV, the observed value of the electric symmetry breaking scale must be regarded as a one part in 100 coincidence. Okay. When you talk to people, often you hear, oh, one part in 100, no big deal, you know, what's the deal, what are you talking about? There are examples in nature of coincidences at this level. So for example, the sun and the moon angular sizes famously coincide to one part in 50, giving us the beautiful phenomenon of eclipses, right? Why are we not surprised by this? Well, we're not surprised by this because our solar system is one of billions. We can go out there at night, look at the sky, and convince ourselves that there are billions of other stars out there, and now we know that there are lots of planets orbiting around them, right? The only reasonable framework, I think, to make sense of non-natural electric symmetry breaking is to regard our physical laws and randomly select it from a large set of possibilities. So if it's really fine-tuned, I don't know what else we can say. Maybe there are ways out, but that's what I hear from, you know, people who are thinking about this. This is a very hard direction to follow, and I find it extremely difficult to, you know. Well, because there is a contribution to it that we can calculate that's 100 times too big.
The top to up quark mass ratio is extraordinarily unequal to one by many orders of magnitude. Is that a sign of one in a 100,000 coincidence?
Say it again, which one?
The top to up quark mass ratio.
Yes.
Is so a factor of 100,000.
Right, so up mass is radiatively stable, right? So I can calculate corrections to it.
But I'm talking about those numbers. A priori, shouldn't they be of order?
Not in the same sense as the electric scale.
Why?
Because here I'm talking about two contributions from different sources from the same thing. Right, there is a contribution.
No, I understand, but you have no idea what produces numbers of order 100,000 in our knowledge of, you know, large parts of what we know about the standard model, what we know about. And you have, and you're simply saying here you have no idea what might produce a factor of 100. I'm not talking about factors of 10 to the 16. I'm talking about factors of 100.
Not quite, because if you think about it at, so if we don't see anything until the 10 TeV scale, we should, let's regard that as the cutoff of the theory. So the upscale mass, upscale you cover at that scale, of quark you cover at that scale, is some number of order 10 to minus 4. Right? The Higgs mass in natural units at that scale is some number of order 1 that has to be at the right value with precision of 1 part in 10 to minus 4 to produce the right answer. To me, this is different. We can continue this. Anyway. Yeah. So anyway, I think this is something that, yeah, we can discuss for a long time. But I think my real point here is that naturalness is a big deal. I don't know how many people here disagree with that, but I do think that naturalness of electroweak symmetry scale is a big deal that we should care about one way or the other. And I think the fact that we can probe it experimentally is important, and we should go out and do it. And, you know, if we discover nothing, we can reevaluate a lot of our thinking, but I think the impact of either seeing something or seeing nothing would be extremely dramatic in this area. I'm convinced of that. Okay? All right. So let me, how much time do I have? 20 minutes. Okay, so let me move on a little bit to the cosmic frontier. So I think the question that we can ask, and at least partially answer, is about dark matter. Is dark matter a thermal relic? It's a very simple possibility, right? And it's actually pretty predictive. So the existence of dark matter is an incontrovertible experimental fact. I don't think anyone would argue with that. The non-standard model nature of dark matter seems extremely likely. And of course, we know a few things about it, but not that much. There are lots of particle physics models that you know, have been constructed for dark matter. Some of them we've heard of this afternoon. I think a useful zeroth order classification of this model is by cosmological history, namely, is it a thermal relic, or is the observed value of the relic of the current density had to do with some sort of non-thermal effects in the early universe? Now, if we say that if it's a thermal relic, with the assumptions that I kind of generically call vanilla here, so vanilla thermal relic scenario, that means no co-annihilations, no resonances, things like that, right? It's a pretty predictive model. So the total pair annihilation cross section is basically determined by the present density of dark matter, which is very well known. And the number that you get, it has actually very little mass dependence. The number that you get happens to be almost exactly 1 picobar. Okay? That's an interesting number. So if I had to guess a mass scale for something that gives me a cross-section of about a picobar, depends on the coupling constant, but if the coupling constant is between 0.1 and 10 to minus 2, I get something between 100 GeV and 20 GeV. And of course, that's on the weak scale, so that gives rise to this idea of WIMPs. But the idea of a thermal relic is even, you know, more general, so alpha could be small, that way M can be, you know, smaller. So it's really a pretty general thing. But the point is, once you say it's thermal and it's vanilla, you know the annihilation cross-section. Okay. This actually allows you to make predictions. The most direct prediction, ironically, that you can make is for indirect detection. And that's because it's the same annihilation process that's just happening today in our neighborhood. Okay? The important caveat, of course, we only know the total annihilation rate, sum over all final states from relic density. So we need a broad range of probes, photons, neutrinos, positrons, as many as possible, so that we're not dependent on which particular channel it happened to decay to annihilate into in the early universe. An equally important caveat, of course, astrophysical backgrounds are in many cases not understood at the level needed to enable a sort of real dark matter search with confidence. Prime example of this is, of course, this Pamela business of the positrons, where we still don't know if the excess is due to dark matter or something like pulsars. And more worryingly, we don't seem to have a real pathway to finding it out. But anyway, with these caveats, indirect detection experiments will begin and are already beginning to get into the interesting cross-section range. This is actually taken from some plots we've seen in this workshop. The gray bands here are the cross-sections predicted by the thermorelic hypothesis. So this is testable. Okay, colliders. You can basically take this process, the annihilation in the early universe, and flip it around. You get production at colliders. This gives potentially observable rates of attack particle like photon or gluon and missing energy predicted for both hadron and lepton colliders. There are again some caveats, but it's clear that colliders will have a role to play in probing this idea of a thermal relic. And finally, direct detection. Unfortunately, there is no sort of direct translation of the predictions of the vanilla thermal relic models for elastic dark matter nucleon scattering. So this requires further theoretical assumptions. But you don't have to, specify an entire high-scale model. You can do it in a very sort of simple general framework, and which is an example of which is this effective operator approach that many people have pursued recently. And so these are some plots from the dark matter complementarity working group, where this line, the line between the green and the yellow, is dividing. So on this line, it would have exactly the cross-section predicted by a thermal relic. And you see that in many cases, we will be able to probe cross-sections below that, which means that we will see something if it's a thermal relic, or eliminate it as a possibility if we don't see something. OK, so I think it seems to me that on the relevant timescales, we might have a real chance to test this vanilla thermal relic dark matter framework through a combination of probes. It would be nice to sort of have this case clearly spelled out somewhere, so I haven't really seen it. It would be nice to state all the caveats and sort of try to minimize them and see if we can really make a watertight case here. My bet is we'll discover it. I'm not betting money, but let's be optimistic. My worry is indirect detection seems very important, and astrophysical explanations, alternative explanations, seem hard to eliminate. Okay. If I'm wrong, I wouldn't be shocked. It wouldn't be shocking from theory point of view to have some non-thermal or non-minimal thermal dark matter. There are lots of other possibilities. Catherine just talked about some of them this afternoon. It's not nearly as predictive, so there are lots of options. And so in that case, I think some sort of very broad program of quote-unquote fishing expeditions would actually be the right approach here. Okay. So the final frontier is the intensity frontier. And I think I want to be somewhat old-fashioned and ask the question this way: is there a grand unification? So there are three strong hints for grand unification, right, that we all know about. So electric charge quantization doesn't make sense unless standard model U1 is embedded inside a non-abelian group. Fermi and quantum numbers in the standard model just beg to be unified in SU5 or larger multiplets. We've known it for a long time, but I actually still remember learning about it for the first time, and it was amazing. It was shocking. Okay. Extrapolated gauge, standard model gauge couplings approximately meet at the high scale. I think given that we're extrapolating from something that's equivalent from a scale of a frog or something to a molecule, it's pretty amazing that they meet as well as they meet even in the standard model. A lot of things can happen, so I think this is actually pretty good. In the MSSM, famously, it's maybe too good to be true, but that's how it is. Okay. Even in an unnatural world, if we're willing to contemplate that, I would bet that some version of gauge unification occurs. It just smells too good to be wrong. Okay. Neutrino mass discovery, then gives a pretty strong hint, further hint for this structure. Hints in particular at SO10 unification or something that includes SO10 inside it. So this has an obvious advantage of having a full standard model generation in a single multiplet. Right-handed neutrino is mandatory, right? It's not an option. And a gut scale mass for nu r is very natural, essentially predicted, with light neutrino masses by CISO mechanism at the scale. And so now we know roughly what these masses are, right? We can figure out what the high scale should be to get us there, we get a number of about 10 to the 14 GeV, which is, again, given the magnitude of the extrapolation, is pretty close to the gauge Kaffin unification scale. Okay, so things actually look very good for jets. Now, what are next steps? Well, we heard about neutrino program in this workshop. So the next steps are basically to, some sense, shrink the error bars here, right? In particular, to determine the overall mass scale. So this will probably be done by cosmological observations first. To determine normal versus inverted mass hierarchy. I'm not sure if cosmology or ground-based experiments will get there first, but it looks like it will be done. CP violation is the prime target for LBME. And then searches for novel beyond the standard model things. Sterile neutrinos, non-standard interactions, and so on. I would bet against it, but again, it's just my feeling. Okay. So what's next for GUTS? Well, physical scales involved in GUTS are probably too high for a precise definitive experimental proof at this point. Okay. So instead, I think what we're doing is we're proceeding by collecting low energy hints or echoes from the GUTS and gradually building up our confidence that something like that is happening. In my opinion, measuring CP masses or discovering or not discovering CP violation doesn't really make a significant impact on the overall case for GUTS. Okay. Of course, people who already believe in it and work on gut models of GUTS, it's probably helpful and useful for them. But in the big picture, I sort of don't see a big impact. What would make a big impact for me is confirmation of a striking and generic prediction of GUTS, which is violation of variant and Neptune numbers. This is something that's hard to get rid of. You can move it around quite a bit, but it's hard to get rid of in grand unified theory. So I think if either one is observed, the case for GUTS would receive a major boost. Okay. So where are we? Well, we've been looking for proton decay for a while. So these are the bounds dominated heavily by the super K. Okay. And they are, depending on the channel, somewhere in the 10 to 33 to 10 to 34 years range. Now, it's complicated, right? Because theoretical predictions are highly uncertain for two reasons. So the first reason is the operators that you can write down depend on, the operators that you generate depend on what's actually happening at the GUTS scale, right? And the second is that the scales where it's happening are model dependent. And because these are high dimension operators, the rates depend on the high power of those scales, okay? But for example, just to take something that's completely generic, right? So this is something that's more supersymmetry specific. This is something that's completely generic. So if I just write this down and say that the gut scale is 10 to the 16 GeV, pretty good number, I get 10 to the 34 years. Okay, that's right around here. Of course, you know, if I multiply this by a factor of 2, well, it goes up an order of magnitude. Okay, so we're not, you know, there's nothing is guaranteed, but we're not in a bad place actually to look for proton decay. Okay, so what's the future? Well, so these are actually plots from the intensity frontier report. So the LBME at home stake, and I pointedly put this arrow here, it does have to be underground, okay, can improve for this particular mode, at least, for example, could improve the super K limit by more than an order of magnitude. There's a proposal for hyper K in Japan that could go also about an order of magnitude in some of the other modes. So I think there's some real chance that, you know, in the next 10 or 20 years, we'll actually see something. Of course, no guarantee implying. Okay. And the final thing along these lines is the lepton number violation, right, which you can search for by looking for neutrinoless double beta decay. And if the neutrino masses are indeed come from unification via seesaw, they are Majorana, and so necessarily lepton number violating. And this actually gives a surprisingly robust, I'm you know, not in this field, so I was actually pretty surprised at how robust the predictions of that for the rate of neutrinoless double beta decay are. Okay? In particular, if there's if the hierarchy of neutrinos is inverted, right, which you know we don't know if it is, but if it is, then experiments that are being talked about now in a sort of one-ton mass range can actually probe this possibility completely. They can probe the whole band, okay? And so we have a very good chance in at least this one possibility, but it's one out of two, so, okay. We have a very good chance for discovery in the conceivable future, okay? So I think I already said all this. So observation of VRL violation, I think, are very good targets for strengthening our case for grand unification. I would not bet on discovery on the relevant timescales, but the odds look decent to be excited about it. Okay. So let me summarize. So in this talk, I shared my views about some of the important physics questions that may be addressed by experimental programs under discussion. Probing naturalness on the electroweak scale, I'm prejudiced, seems to me to be the single most important issue on this list. Combination of direct probes and precision Higgs physics offers an opportunity to pretty much settle this issue. I mean, you would need to wiggle pretty hard to build something natural if this program doesn't see anything. Okay. I think it will have a huge impact on physics, whichever way it goes. I hope that the US community will have an opportunity to make a major contribution to this quest in some way. And I think I have a couple of minutes. So this was supposed to be a visionary talk. Great. So here we go. Visions first. So one thing that's been amusing in this process is to kind of see how people channel their ideas about what snow mass should be into pictures. So here are some pictures that we saw on the first day of this workshop, right? And I think, yeah, sure, it would be nice if snow mass was, you know, kind of like that. Why not? But then, you know, then we all know deep in the unconscious, we all know that human nature is not like that, right? It's actually a little bit darker. And sometimes this unconscious just kind of breaks out, and it breaks out into postures, right? So this picture is from a poster that many of you probably have on a wall in your institution. Yeah, and so here the frontiers are kind of frontiers between the different areas rather than, you know, outside. So this brings to mind some sort of a feudal, you know, kind of thing. So the picture I wanted to contribute to this list is this picture. So I think what snow mass really should be is a symposium, right? It's a place where we get together and we do what we do best. We discuss physics freely and honestly, and we argue about it. We don't reach a consensus, but, you know, we make progress. And I think we are very fortunate that our intellectual ancestors are really these guys, not these guys or these guys, right? And I think we should do what we know how to do. And I think the participants here will agree that the last 3 days was really a symposium in the best sense of the word. And so I want to finish by thanking the KATP for hosting us and thanking the workshop organizers for giving us an opportunity to be here and talk about physics.
We have time for just one burning comment. No burning comments. Okay, let's thank Maxime again. So Michael asked to say a few words at the end here today. And I would like for all of us to give our thanks to Michael, because he really put a lot of time and energy and effort into organizing this meeting. And I think it was very successful. And thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you. Okay. So.